The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Common sins that you're going to see in your students, and the thing I don't have time to do, it would take about twice as much time to cover all of this, but as you go through and you talk about sins that your students might commit in your classroom, one thing you need to be aware of as a teacher is that addressing sin in your students' lives is something that really should go hand in hand with you addressing sin in your own life. So these five things, if you look at the outline, disobedience, dishonesty, discontent, dissension, dawdling, those sorts of things are the same sorts of issues that we should be really diligent about rooting out in our own life. Because the best way to discipline a class or to discipline your own kids is to show them by your example. So I won't have time for that, but maybe you can make application as we go through. Couple ground rules. Number one is discipline as imitation. And so if you were in the workshop yesterday where we talked about covenant discipline, I talked about the paradigm for faithful child rearing at home, which is really the same as it is in the classroom, which comes down to you imitating God. Because if anybody was ever good at raising kids, it was God. Okay, He does it perfectly. And again, we have a written record of how He's raised His children, but you also have firsthand experience on how God has been raising you over the years and sanctifying you. And so we take all of our cues from Him, which is really nice, right? You don't have to worry about whether Whitling is giving you good advice or not, or whether whether you're listening to the right tape right now. It really doesn't come down to the right tape. It comes down to you knowing who God is, loving Him, following after Him, and wanting to be like Him. And it's really simple on the front end. You just think, look, I'm just trying to be a copycat. That's what faithfulness, that's what success in life comes down to. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. Whether you want to be a good father, or whether you want to be a good husband, or a good administrator, or a good teacher, or mailman, or whatever it comes down to, faithfulness means imitating God. And so if you're heading in that direction, you're on the right road. And each step you make, you're closer to being successful, doing well. So the first ground rule is discipline is an act of imitation. And some of the particulars within that paradigm that we talked about yesterday are we see God, He teaches His people, He trains His people, and then He blesses and curses. Blesses for obedience and curses for disobedience. And so that's my mantra, right? If someone says, look, I've got this problem with my 4-year-old, or I have this problem with my 18-year-old. We're having this issue in kindergarten. In the back of my mind, I'm already thinking through, okay, well, what are we teaching? What are we training? And then how are we blessing or cursing based on where we are? And so I'm going to work through those three categories as we talk about these five sins. So that's the first ground rule. Second thing is we all need to understand that when we talk about discipline, we're talking about love. So it's not sometimes you can describe discipline as a battle for classroom control and a battle of the wills or whatever, however you want to describe it. But really, when we look at the scriptures, faithful, godly discipline is an act of love. And so you can see this really clearly in Proverbs 13:24, where it says, "He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly." And, in this day and age in particular, there are parents that would tell you, I would never spank my son or daughter. And the reason for it is I love her too much. I love him too much, right? And so we have, you know, it's a photo negative. It's the exact opposite of what the Word of God says. And so we need to have our bearings straight and make sure, you know, we hold our plumb line up. Anytime somebody starts to say something, I would never, 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 you just pull your plumb line out and say, okay, let's see what they have to say. Hold up the Word of God. And I'm not talking about any discipline, you know, is an act of love, but faithful, godly, self-controlled discipline done according to the Scriptures is a gift that you're giving to your child, is a gift that you're giving to the students in your class. And the motivation for it is love. You love them, right? You love them so much that you'd never let them do that. Or you love them so much that, yeah, I would spank them. In fact, I'd spank my son lots because I love him so much, right? Every time he needs it. And that's something that should be self-consciously taught, I think. There are certain times when your kids are young, the way that we do that, because we want them to see the connection in a way that's not really obvious in the world today, is after a spanking with our kids when they're young, kind of 2 or 3 or 4, after a spanking and we've prayed and hugs and kisses and everything, I'll look at Bo. Bo's my 3-year-old right now, so he's the one getting the most spanks nowadays. Although he is the youngest and probably is not getting as many as he should. But, you know, Bo will get a spanking and we're all done with the whole thing. And then I can look at Bo and say, Bo, why does Papa spank you so much? And he'll look and kind of smile and say, because he loves me. So that's exactly right. But he didn't just come up with that on his own, right? I mean, I taught him that. And so it's this weird, you know, it's this weird thing. And some people feel really guilty. You know, your job as parents and as teachers is to teach your kids to honor you, to teach them to respect you and to obey you. And you can't just kind of hope that it happens. You know, we'll read some passages in Ephesians and hope it sticks, right? I mean, it's got to be self-conscious. You teach them the words to use. This is what you should say to show honor to me. And you think, oh, that just feels really weird. Well, you've got to get over it. It's your job to teach them those sorts of things. So discipline as love. Third and final ground rule is public offenses should receive public consequences. Okay, so public offenses should receive public consequences. And what I mean by that, the idea comes from Proverbs 21, verse 11, where it says, when the scoffer is punished, the naive becomes wise. Okay, when the scoffer is punished, the naive becomes wise. And in any classroom, you know, if you have more than 3 or 4 students, you're going to have kids that, to one extent or another, are scoffers, are naive, and are wise, or are wise. And the, you know, the simple description for each of those three, the wise kids are the kids that come into your classroom and they sit down, they've got their pencil sharp and it's ready and they're poised and they're just ready for you to say, go, and they're going to charge, right? And they respect you, they honor you, they understand that you stand in the place of their parents, they love their parents, they respect their parents, and so it's just an easy transfer to you. And they're just go-getters in the classroom. Those are your wise students. And it doesn't take very long to spot them, right? I mean, they're just bright, shiny faces, and here we go. You know, point us in the right direction, Mr. Whitling sort of thing. And the your naive students are the kids that come in, and they're just in the middle, and they're watching to see what the rules of the game are. But they don't really have an unpleasant disposition, nor do they have a pleasant disposition. They're not a go-getter, wise kid, but they're not a scoffer either. They're just there, right? And it's this pretty, sometimes those can be most of the kids. But those are naive kids. And then the scoffers are the kids that come in pushing buttons, right? They, even before the first day of school has started, you know, if you had a meet the teacher sort of event before school starts, they're the ones that are on your radar screen. I mean, just right now, you know, they come in the classroom and all of a sudden you think, okay, I'm keeping my eye on him. And, you know, you haven't even had much contact with them, but they're pushing buttons, but they're pushing boundaries also. And, you know, oftentimes they're boys, but the The deal is, when you have a classroom that has these three categories of students in there, this verse in particular comes into play, right? When the scoffer is punished, the naive becomes wise. And so if there's an event that takes place, anytime the scoffer scoffs in class, you have an opportunity to teach the naive to become wise. And if you ignore the behavior or just downplay it or think he'll grow out of it or whatever it happens to be, what you have going on is your naive are watching the scoffer scoff and then watching you to see what your response is. And if you don't address it at all, they're learning the lesson, right? They're watching. The naive kid heard the scoff from the back row, and then everybody watched to see what the teacher would do, and the teacher didn't do anything. She just kept writing on the board, right? Didn't even bat an eye. And your naive kid thinks, okay, I know what's acceptable in this classroom. And the scoffer thinks, whew, I can do worse than that, right? And your wise kid heard the scoff, looked for the response, and nothing happened. And so all of a sudden you start losing credibility with the wise kids in your class, right? Because they think, what is this? Who is this? She doesn't even care about what's going on in the classroom here. But if you rewind the tape and you address, and it should be graciously, you know, if someone's a scoffer and it's the first day of school, I had one little homeschooler, first day of school for this young man in third grade a number of years ago, and he just came in with rough edges. You know, I mean, he wanted to talk to me like I was his peer. And he had no concept of raise your hand to be, you know, raise your hand, be called on. I mean, when he had a thought in his mind, it just came out. Just right now. And I thought, oh boy, you know, here we go. It's going to be a couple days, and they're either going to leave the school or he's going to be a great kid after that. But, you know, scoffer scoffs, and you address it right away and say, I'm sorry, that is not acceptable in this classroom. And again, you're self-controlled, but, you know, that it's just not. And in that situation, you have the naive kids hear the scoff, see the response, and they think, okay, I'm not gonna do that. I don't want to do that. And your wise kid hears the scoff and sees the response and thinks, yes, right? That's just what my dad would have done. And then things are going the way that they ought to. By public consequences, I don't mean that all the details should be public. Okay, so in other words, if someone cheats on a test or something, you don't bring them in front of the classroom and say, this is what happens to cheaters, you know, and spank them in front of everyone. But at the same time, everybody should know that things are coming apart for that little person if there was some kind of public offense. Here's an example. A couple years ago, we had a high school senior who was our rhetoric teacher passed out a packet for speech meet and said, this packet of papers is very important. I want you guys to keep it for the next 3 weeks. Please take really good care of it. We're going to be referring to this sheet over the next couple weeks. And then he said, let's look at page one. And we had a student in the front row who went, and there was a giggle or two from behind him, you know, because a few kids saw it. And our rhetoric teacher said, okay, look at point one. And what I want to do is direct your attention to the, and he looked over, and this high school senior was ripping the packet apart during the lecture. And that's scoffing, right? I mean, I could spot that one. And in that situation, if the teacher thinks, well, he's ripping the packet, okay, I can get him another one. It's not, you know, I don't want to be distracted. Let's just ignore the misbehavior at this point. You know, realize the effect that it has on that entire class. But the teacher saw that and said, oh, well, that's easy. Office visit, right? And sends him into the office. And of course, none of these things are isolated situations. It was a pattern. And so we kicked him out kicked him out of school. He was done. Well, and that sent a really good message to our seniors, right? These are kids that are getting ready to graduate in a few months, and all of a sudden your naive kids realize what they don't want to do in class. You know, you don't rip up the paper that your teacher says, please take good care of this. And your wise kids think, yeah, that's good. You know, that's good. It's good he's not part of this mix anymore. But sometimes it means, you know, it means taking serious measures. So anyway, those are our three ground rules. Discipline is imitation. Discipline is love. And then public offenses should have some sort of public consequences. And now let's dive in and talk about a few different sins that you may encounter in your classroom. Number one is disobedience. And by disobedience, there are really two different sorts that we'll see. One is immediate disobedience, and that's kind of the example I was just showing. Or if you asked a student to sit down and he said no, right? And some people would say, well, that's rebellion. You know, it's rebellion or direct disobedience. Those are the things that are really easy to spot. I mean, it's in your face, and you've got to choose to ignore it if you're going to. But they're just right there. And then the second kind is what could be called subsequent disobedience, which means the teacher gives, you know, a number of commands at the beginning of the school year, or school rules or class rules. You know, it could be nickel dime stuff like don't chew gum in the hallway or don't talk while I'm talking or things like that. And then, you know, 3 days later or 3 weeks later or whatever it is, somebody's doing that thing and you have to deal with the disobedience at that point. And so what do we teach? What do we train? And then how do we bless and curse for those for that particular sin? The thing that we teach is Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 2. It says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment, with a promise. And we want our elementary students to memorize that, be able to explain it, and be able to obey it. And we want to teach them to see their teacher as standing in the place of their parents during the school day. And so we want them to show respect and obedience to their teacher the way that they would to their parents, or sadly to say, in some cases, better. Right? We expect more sometimes than what they would give to their parents. How do you train? Well, we have, I had one classroom rule in third grade and the same classroom rule in sixth grade, which was obey right away, all the way, and with a good attitude every day. Okay, that's our one house rule at home, and that's our one school room in the class or rule in the classroom. So obey right away, all the way, and with a good attitude every day. And we have the kids memorize that, and they say that, and we have assembly sayings that we do. So all of our elementary students have that rule memorized. And so you can tell them that. Remember that when you're dealing with elementary age kids, telling them the classroom rule counts for nothing. Right? I mean, say, right away, all the way, and with a good attitude every day. You could even teach it to them. Have them say it back to you. They have it memorized. And then you could say, does everyone understand what that means? And they would all say, and again, just translate in your mind, no, Mr. Whitling, we don't have a clue. We have no concept of anything that you think we know at this point. You know, just zero. The words mean nothing to them. And so you have to unpack it. You have to train them what that means. And so you tell them stories, but you'll have them experience and practice and so forth. And so we'll talk about the three things. Right away means that your obedience needs to be immediate. And any time between when the command was issued and when you got around to doing it, any seconds that go by are disobedient seconds. And so if a student is up sharpening his pencil and you say, John, please sit down, and his desk is over there, and he walks that way to go and bump his friend on the way back to his chair, every step this direction was disobedience, right? Because it wasn't immediate. And he can't say, but I was going to my desk, right? And oftentimes at home, that sort of thing is acceptable, right? You can say, but I was going to my desk, Mom, and then she's frustrated, doesn't know what to do, and that's the end. You know, there's an excuse that's accepted. But kids need to realize that when you ask them to do something, it needs to be now. It should be yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and then boom, just right away, the obedience should be immediate. And if it's not, then it's disobedience. So right away, all the way means that the obedience needs to be complete. Okay, doing half of what was asked is not obedience. And so if you ask your kids to clean their rooms and they stuff everything under their bed or push everything into their closet and shut the door, they didn't obey because it's not all the way. Okay, so obedience needs to be complete. You need to obey all the way. And then with a good attitude every day simply means that obedience needs to be cheerful. Okay, so when you ask somebody to do something, it should be yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and then running off to do it. And again, your students or your kids at home, you know, just talking, just saying the words won't make any difference at all to them, other than they might think you're strange. But when you work them through examples, have them practice transitions, go up, have them line up for recess. You know, when we ring a bell, everybody's playing at recess and we ring a bell, that's the equivalent of the teacher saying, please line up. Okay, it's a command. And so if you don't line up now, you're disobeying. If your line's not straight, it's disobedience. And if you've got a nasty attitude about having to line up and go back to that classroom, same sort of thing. And so you have to go through and explain and kind of unpack what your expectations are for your students. And when you do that, sometimes the response is going to be kids that are shocked, right? Because they've never been held to a standard like this before. And so it goes back to you making sure they understand it's not just that you're uptight, it's that you love them. And because you love them, you want to teach them these things so that they'll obey God the same way. Okay, when he issues a command, do we as teachers and parents, is it right away, all the way, and with a good attitude every day? Okay, that's what we're seeking to impose upon ourselves because we want to be faithful. And it's the same sort of gift we're trying to give to our young people as we bring them up. Okay, and then blessing and cursing. You know, how do you deal with the results of what you see in your kids? On the blessing side, I really think that verbal encouragement is very, very valuable. And you as a teacher being able to express your pleasure in how your students have done is probably the most valuable thing you can give to them. Because the whole deal between a teacher and his class or her class comes down to the relationship between you and them. And so you've got to be able to be good at expressing your favor when your students have done well. And I talked about that a little bit yesterday as far as trying to catch your kids obeying and then showing them your pleasure when they do. We start off the school year, first 5 minutes of class, I always talk to the kids about attention, please. And so anytime that I want my students' attention, I'll tell them, you know, we might be dissecting pig hearts, or we might be taking engines apart, or we might be having an interesting discussion, or it might be group work. And whenever I want to have your attention, I'm not going to throw chalk at you, and I'm not going to flip the lights, and I'm not going to ring a bell or yell or anything like that. All I'm going to do is say, attention, please. And I'm going to say it about that loud. And when you hear that, I want you to freeze, and I want all of your eyes on me. Because then I'm going to show you something really neat, or I'm going to talk to you about something that's really important. And I'll say, does everybody understand that? And they'll say, yes. And again, you say, no, they don't. Okay? And so you have to train them. You say, all right, okay, what I'd like you to do is when I say go, I want you to talk to your neighbor. Don't listen to your neighbor, just talk. I want you to talk the whole time. And then when I say attention, please, we'll see how we do. Ready? Go. And they'll just talk to each other, and then about this loud, I'll say, attention, please. And it'll go, brrr. It'll kind of graduate into silence, and some people in the back row will then hear that it's quiet, and so they'll stop talking and look at me. And I'll look at the class and say, that was pitiful. Just terrible. And then stop and let it sink in a little bit. And you say, when I said attention, please, I had two people that stopped right away, and then a bunch of middle kids that stopped 3 seconds later, and then two girls were talking in the back row for 5 or 7 seconds after I had said it. And then they'll want to raise their hand and say, "But Mr. Whitling, we didn't hear you." And I'll say, "That's exactly right. And that was your first mistake, because you were talking so loud in class that you couldn't even hear me." And again, it takes time, right? I'm not teaching math right now. But these are the sorts of lessons that recalibrate young people. Because when they go through that, all of a sudden they're thinking, okay, you know, we're dealing with a different sort of situation than maybe we have been in the past. And it ratchets up what they think your expectations really are. And you're just trying to communicate straight up the middle what you really want to see in there. So encourage them when they do well. When they don't do well, we talked about a verbal rebuke, you know, holding them accountable. And especially in the first 2 weeks of the school year, I think that the most effective thing that you can do is if somebody talks without raising their hand or whatever it is, we all realize that's not the end of the world, but you want to stop and have everybody learn from it without you losing your cool. You can draw your attention to it and say, "Okay, John, what did you just do that we've been working on?" I say, "Oh, I didn't raise my hand. I wasn't called on before I spoke." I say, "That's right. What does God think of that?" I say, "It's disobedience." I say, "That's exactly right. That's not acceptable in here." And especially first 2 weeks of class, we see it as a time of training where we're all learning how to follow the rules and what the expectations are. If that happens in, you know, 4 weeks in, then we've got a bigger issue, because I know I've done my job as a teacher to teach and train up to that point. Let's talk about dishonesty. In students, this is seen in wandering eyes during a math test, slips of paper cascading to the floor during a history final, or light pencil markings on the top of the desk during a spelling test, and otherwise known as cheating, right? And there are other sorts of dishonesty, but in an academic setting, really one of the biggest issues is cheating. Kids that are looking on somebody else's paper or somehow trying to work together to cheat. And if you think that being in a classical and Christian school makes you somehow immune to these sorts of issues, it's not true. In fact, in some ways, you're more vulnerable to these kinds of issues because you have kids that are motivated and parents that are motivated and have very, very high expectations for their kids. They, you know, they're paying money to have their kids in this school. And things like transcripts matter a lot to parents. And so there can be pressure that is put on students, or just straight up the middle sin from a student who is trying to get a better grade than they would if they used their own brain on this test. And there have been a number of studies done on the who's who kids, you know, who's who high schoolers. They compile lists of the top-notch kids every year. And all of the studies say universally the same thing with a little bit of different percentages each year. The studies say that the majority of high school students, when they're polled, admit to having cheated on a test sometime during their high school career. Usually upwards of 95% of the students who are polled say, "Yes, I cheated at least once." The next question they ask them is, "Were you caught?" 85 to 90% of them say, "No, never." Then they ask the parents, "Do you think your son or daughter ever cheated when they were in high school?" Guess what the parents say? No. 65 to 70% of the time, parents say, "Not my son. He would never do that." And these are the best kids, right? These are the who's who kids. So they're going to be similar to the kids that you have in your classroom. And some of what we need to realize is that, you know, some people think, well, cheating, that's really bad. Cheating is a common temptation. If you're a student in a classroom, these are the sorts of temptations that arise every day. And if you talk to college professors, there are many college professors that teach these large, you know, basic level classes with 100 or 200 or 300 students in their classroom. They spend the majority of their time trying to outsmart their students. right? So how am I going to pass out my exams so that the exams for the guy right here are different than the exams from the girl sitting next to him? You know, how do we foil all of the cheating that's going on in college? And so it's something that we have to deal with. And I think the first step toward dealing with it faithfully is recognizing that your child may be tempted to cheat. So what do we teach? Exodus 20:15, thou shalt not steal. Ephesians 4:28, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. And the short form of it is, hard work is the antidote to stealing possessions as well as stealing answers. And how do you train? Well, we talk to our kids. Our 2 years where we focus really intensely on this issue are second and third grade. Okay, I believe that if you can learn to keep your eyes on your own paper in second or third grade, it is one of the biggest gifts that we can give to our students to prepare them for junior high, high school, and college. And why second and third grade? Because those are the years that it becomes more academic, at least at our school. Okay, we have more tests. We're giving real grades, A through F, in second grade. And so this issue of you being accountable for your own work and your eyes being on your own paper really comes into play. The majority of our office visits during the school year from second and third grade are cheating issues. And we know it, and so we teach and we train, and we're really working through these issues so the students are prepared for them. First way to train is to make sure your students understand that if they look on somebody else's paper and take an answer and write it down, two things are going on. One is they've stolen that person's answer, and the next thing is they've lied to their teacher. Okay, so it's stealing and it's lying. When you turn it in and say, this was my, number five was my answer, Mr. Whitling, that's a lie. It's not the case. That's actually their answer that you took. And so working through this with your students can help them see exactly what's at stake and where they are in the whole thing. Next thing that we focus on heavily is keeping your eyes in a wise spot. And that's the phrase that we use. So before a test, we're going to talk to the kids, especially second and third graders, make sure you keep your eyes in a wise spot. And we'll talk about where the wise places are in the classroom. You should know. You should have a plan of attack when you go into an exam where you can put your eyes and where you shouldn't. And we, third grade years ago when I was teaching third grade, I was going through this song and dance routine at the beginning of the year about eyes in a wise spot. And I was giving a spelling test, and I was walking around. It's always good to circulate throughout the room. Walking around, and I'd give a word. Kids would write it down. And then you've got to pause, right? You've got a period of time where you've got to look somewhere for 5 or 10 or 15 seconds while you're waiting for the second word. And we got through five words or something, and I looked over, and a young man was writing his sixth word, wrote his sixth word, and then he goes, and I looked at him, and you kind of see funny behaviors during a test, and you think, okay, what does that mean? and I saw that, thought, oh, yeah, love covers over a multitude of sins. I don't know what his problem is, but I read the next word. He wrote it down, same thing. And the kid behind him is kind of going, looking at him, and then looking at me. And I'm looking at him and looking at him, and I kind of walked over and thought, this is really weird. And it took the third time of him doing that again until all of a sudden it hit me that he was putting his eyes in a wise spot after every word. And many times that's what obedience looks like in boys, right? It's... And you think, you know, you have to separate the wheat from the chaff because oftentimes the moms in particular are tempted to clobber the chaff. You know, they just think it's all chaff straight through. But what the nugget of gold was is he had listened to my instructions and he had picked a spot and he was just being ultra disciplined about keeping his eyes on his own paper. And so we had a little readjustment. You have to do this with boys. You say, look, here's what I really liked about what you did, and then here's a way to do it better. You know, let's don't do that anymore, because everybody's looking at you. Look at the ceiling. But sometimes just being able to talk to your students about this thing called cheating, and it's not a top-down thing all the time. You can tell them stories. I had one of my favorite teachers in junior high was named Mr. Freeman, and he talked to us about stories, or talked to us about times when he was in junior high or high school, he had friends that had this tapping system down for cheating, and all their science tests were true-false. And what they would do is they'd tap the number of the question, right? So the number of the question would be 3, just on your desk. And then one tap was true, and 2 taps was false, right? And so you could go through the test that way, and you think, well, great, you know, your teacher taught you how to cheat on true and false tests. But it wasn't that at all. It was Mr. Freeman entering into our world and talking to us about things to look for and avoid, right? It was this whole training thing of hypothetical situations that you want to be able to spot and avoid when you get there. And so the training really is the majority of the battle. The other thing that's really helpful for students to know in a very academic setting is that there's a time and a place to fail a test to the glory of God, okay? Because especially elementary-aged kids can sometimes erroneously equate doing well on a test with being a good student, okay? And those can be two different things. Let's say you didn't prepare as well as you should have for the test, and you get in there, or the test, you know, every now and then the test really is on something that you didn't prepare for, and you get into the middle of it and you think, well, I put my name down and the date, and I think those are the only two blanks that I'm going to get right. Okay, because you just obviously don't know it well, you've got a choice at that point. You can say, well, I'm going to, you know, and you should guess on as many as you can and all that, you know, test strategy stuff. But a young person needs to know that faithfulness, the most important thing in life right now, is failing this test to the glory of God, which means that my eyes are on my own paper and that being good right now doesn't mean getting all the right answers. Okay, so I can turn this thing in knowing that I bombed it, but I was faithful, and God was pleased with the faithfulness. Now, maybe the lesson should be, you know, you've got to prepare more effectively next time, whatever the problem was, but they should realize that they could do well in the midst of temptation by getting it wrong, instead of always the goal is you've got to have the right answer. And for a third grader, there are all sorts of weird ideas that they might have that you think, well, I didn't teach them that, but it might be there that needs to be addressed. Okay, blessing and cursing. If you see kids that are taking your advice and really keeping their eyes in a safe spot, on their desk is usually the best spot. Okay, you can look at a teacher in between spelling words, but that draws more attention to yourself than you may want, right? Because as a teacher, you know that the kids that are spending all their time looking at you during a test, usually there's something going on that that you're concerned about. But if you see kids' eyes on their own paper, tell them, well done. Doesn't mean that you've seen everything that's going on, but you can highlight and say, look, I'm seeing a number of students in here in between spelling words, and your eyes are down on your own paper, and I'm really pleased. Keep up the great work. Simple way to bless your students. If you see students that are not looking on their own paper during a test, for us, in our discipline policy, it's just an automatic office visit. Okay, so you don't. If I'm in the middle of a test and I'm looking on somebody else's paper, the teacher does not have to read my mind and figure out whether I'm looking in order to see whether I'm ahead of that person next to me. And this is very common for second and third grade boys in particular. They're on number 7. I wonder if he's on number 7 because he's racing, right? And he's not looking for anybody's answers. He's wanting to finish before that kid next to him. Well, he needs to be taught and trained what's at stake. you know, if your eyes are on his paper during an exam, we're going to handle it as cheating regardless of whether we can prove that you took an answer or why you were looking or whatever it is. And this is something that's really important. You know, if you homeschool your kids, these are some of the sorts of lessons that you have to fabricate somehow at home, because we've seen high school students come into exams. They're homeschooled all the way up to 9th grade or 10th grade or 11th grade, come into a chemistry final exam, and some little person can't keep her eyes on her own paper. She fails it. It's a zero on the exam. And the response is, Mr. Whitling, you don't think that I would cheat, do you? I mean, I'm not a cheater. And how do you know whether they did cheat or not? Well, we don't. But our policy is, if your eyes are on somebody else's paper during a test, it's a zero. It's an office visit. We're going to talk to your parents about it. And we might believe you. You know, I've had a young lady tell me, look, my eyes were just straying. I was thinking about the answer. I'll say, that's good. You know, I'm good with that. That's between you and God and your parents. And if your conscience bothers you about it in the future, make things right. But it's still a zero on the exam. And it's still an office visit for this situation because of the foolishness of where you had your eyes during this test. And again, this is something they should have learned in second and third grade. So if you homeschool, you've got to somehow come up with a system to train your kids to do that. Discontent. In students, this is otherwise known as complaining. Can be announced by a roll of the eyes, sigh of the breath, or in extreme cases, a whining moan. And so what do you teach? We teach Job 1, 20 through 22. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Ephesians 5:15 is similar. Give thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And Philippians 2:14 and 15. Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God, without fault in a crooked and depraved generation, in which you shine like stars. And so essentially all that comes down to this. Whatever's on your plate is there because God put it there, right? And so when you sit down to dinner, the response is thank you, right? Because God knows what should be served up at what time in your life. And so thank you is the appropriate response, and whining and complaining are not. And so how do you train? Well, talking about this is very helpful. But what I did with my sixth graders is if I noticed a pattern of kind of the rolling of the eyes, you give a hard writing assignment, and if you have kids going, and another five paragraph essay, then I would address it with them and talk to them about being thankful in tough situations. And my temptation is always to, if I see that sort of thing, to drive at it instead of away from it. So in other words, I would tell them, look, I think we as a class have a real problem with complaining about assignments. And so I just want you to know that over the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to be giving you some really tough assignments. And some of them will be real and some of them will be fake assignments. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give them to you, and then I'm going to watch your face and I'm going to see how you respond. And you don't know whether it's real or whether it's fake. And we do this with our fourth graders. There's something about fourth grade where fourth graders really like to point out mistakes that their teachers have made. And when I taught Latin in fourth grade a number of years ago, it was really striking how I didn't see it at all with my third graders. And the fifth and sixth graders, it wasn't as much of an issue. Maybe it's just us. But our fourth graders, you know, if you say Tuesday and it really should be Wednesday, I mean, they just want to point it out, you know. If any sort of mistake, they're just all over it like sharks. You know, four or five of them, just right there. And you can't go on with the lesson, right? Because everything stops. They're not thinking. They're not with you anymore. They're thinking, nope, it was Wednesday. It was Wednesday. It was Wednesday. It was Wednesday. And I noticed this after a couple of weeks. And I thought, this is nuts. You know, we can't do this anymore. And I had tried to kind of bat it away, you know, gently loosen up, loosen your shoelaces, you know, tried to get them to knock it off. And I realized that this was an issue that had them by the throat. They couldn't let it go. And so I came in and I said, all right, here's our problem. You may have noticed this, or maybe you haven't yet, but anytime the teacher makes a mistake, you guys are just beside yourself trying to point it out. Have you guys ever noticed that? There's a few kids say, oh, yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that. I said, yep, I noticed that too. So here's what I'm going to do. Over the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm just going to start making tons of mistakes. I mean, I'm going to say things wrong on purpose because I think this is a real problem that you need to get over. And so what I want you to do is if you hear me say something wrong, you can't raise your hand, can't say a word. All you can do is smile. And I'll know if I see you smiling that you caught the mistake and nobody else did. Do you guys understand that? I'll say yes. And then all of a sudden you've got a game that you're playing with your students. And some of your sharpest kids are some of the ones that are the most picky about some of these details, and they want to win. They're competitive. And so what we've done is we've changed the whole thing around where, you know, every now and then I make a mistake on purpose, but nobody can tell whether it's an on-purpose whittling mistake or whether it was an accident. And if I make a mistake, I'll look out and I'll see some smiles and I'll think, oh, I must have made a mistake. But what a better response than the shark mentality, you know, where there's a little bit of blood in the water and they're after you. So I found that driving at the problem and changing it into a game can be some of the best training because it's fun. They feel like they're playing a game now, and we can address the problem, and I can make 5 mistakes in the next 5 minutes if I want to. Or if we're getting better, I can just leave it behind and forget about it, and we've conquered that particular issue. But sometimes that can be a real help. What else? Another way to train is be wary of allowing kids to cheer for assignments that they really like. Okay, because if you allow this expectation where students know that if they really like the assignment, they go yes. Then why not, if you really don't like the assignment, can't you go, ugh, right? Because you're letting them stamp their approval or disapproval after you give it. Now, it can be really encouraging as a teacher if they say yes. But when it's something that's just tough, I mean, it's something hard they really need to do and it's good for them and they've got to work on it, it's bad for them to allow them to get into that pattern of saying, ugh. And so I nip both in the bud. Because what I want them to do is just say thank you when they're dealing with these things. Blessing and cursing, we've talked about that a little bit, driving into the problem. If the kids are doing something very difficult and they're cheerful and hardworking, I like to surprise them with things like donuts and juice. Okay, so in sixth grade, there are times when we would read through a really difficult book, like Tale of Two Cities, which for sixth graders is challenging. And when I saw them doing that, cheerful, hardworking, diving into it and really working hard, then I've got surprises that are going to come around. And they didn't work for it, or you know, they don't have 5 smiley points that get them a party or anything like that. But I think you ought to be in the habit of surprising your students with really fun, this is a well done way to go, and here's why. And you can tell them why you're so pleased with their behavior. But it's got to be genuine. It can't be a fake thing that you're making up in order to manipulate them. All right, let's talk about dissension. Dissension is seen in a classroom where there is strife, discord, quarreling, wrangling among the students. Sometimes it can just be between two kids. You can say, these two boys, for some reason, just don't get along. Or these three girls are trouble when they're together. And so that's the sort of thing that I mean by dissension. So what do you teach? Proverbs 6:16-19. There are 6 things the Lord hates, 7 that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are swift to rush to evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a man who stirs up dissension among brothers. And Ephesians 4, 31 and 32 is similar to this. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put far away from you, along with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you. And these are things that that we talk to our students about. It's important to know that when you're dealing with first graders or third graders or fifth graders, these sorts of big issues don't just come out of nowhere. There are little seeds of dissension that are planted in kids when they're very young that, if they're allowed to grow into fruition, are the big, ugly trees that you're looking at in a church split or a church fight or whatever the nasty such a school split situation that you're in. That didn't just come out of the blue, right? These things are patterns that many times have gone on for years and years and years. And people get really, really good at stirring up dissension, or really, really good at being thankful and gracious and kind and so forth. And so you're building up to a crescendo where you're aiming. So how do you deal? How do you train for these sorts of things? In the classroom, we talk to our students about two different kinds of dissension, or two different kinds of issues that they're going to need to watch out for and deal with faithfully. There are minor issues and there are major issues. And kids need to know this, especially elementary age students, because sometimes they don't know what's a big deal and what's not. Okay? And so for us, our major issues are disobedience to parents or teachers, disrespect to the same, cheating, lying, anything that would endanger you or anybody else, fighting, those sorts of things are big issues. If there's a big issue going on, the godly response is to go to the person and say, "You can tell Mr. Whitling or I will." Okay, so we had this happen a couple of years ago. Young lady cheated on a final exam in an 11th grade class. The gal behind her saw her looking on the other student's paper. Teacher didn't see it. It was more than once. And the gal who saw it going on after the test went up to her friend and said, "Either you can tell the science teacher or I will. But he needs to know." And she and the one who had cheated said, "Thanks, I'll do it," went and told what had taken place. Why? You know, what would motivate a high school kid? I've had that same sort of thing happen in sixth grade. What would motivate a student to do that to one of their other classmates? Love. Right? I mean, it goes back to the ground rules that we talked about. The reason that you, as a teacher, would keep your eyes up during a test and watch your students, the reason that you would circulate through the rows, is love. It's not because you're this vulture trying to catch kids who are cheating, right? Because you like it. And who likes it? It's awful. But it's because you love them that you'll hold them accountable. And, you know, Proverbs says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy." These sorts of lessons learned in elementary, junior high, and high school are the sorts of friendship concepts that we as a people need for adults. And being able to hold somebody accountable and say, "Either you go tell them or I'm going to have to tell them," is just a way to love your neighbor. It doesn't mean that your motives are always pure, but it does mean that's the sort of thing that we teach to our students. And for a major issue, it's got to come to light. You can't just say, "Hey, you should pray about that and, you know, ask forgiveness and don't tell anybody that you really cheated on the test." It's got to come to light. Major issues. Minor issues are things like his elbow is always on my desk. Right? I mean, this is fifth and sixth grade. We've got small classrooms. The kids are in pretty tight. And some boy can't keep his body parts on his own desk. And most of the time, he has no clue what he's doing, okay? I mean, his elbow is all over her desk. And she's going, you know, and she's trying to use the bottom left-hand corner of her desk because he's just hanging out all over. Well, she needs to know what to do about that, right? Same sort of thing. Somebody steps on your foot in the hallway. Somebody cuts in front of you in line on the way to the swings or on the way to the slide. These are all minor offenses. And so we'll talk to our students. It's a minor offense. This is a minor offense. This is a minor offense. What should you do? Love covers a multitude of minor offenses, which means his elbow's on your desk. Love should cover that. Now, if it's a pattern, and we define a pattern by three or more times, okay, if it happens once, it's not a pattern. Twice, still not a pattern enough for us. If it's three or more times where you think, his elbow's always on my desk, then what we teach our kids is to talk to him and say, will you please not put your elbow on my desk? And if it happens again, they come and talk to me as the classroom teacher, and I'll make sure that it stops. Okay? So for the nickel-dime things, happens one or two times, love covers that. And there should be love covering tons of that stuff. We're all so quirky, right? As adults, there are things we say, our tone of voice. You think, gee whiz, what is he talking about? There are things that you should just think, love covers that, love covers that, love covers that. Just all day long, there should be 100 things like that that love is covering between you and your friends and you and your colleagues and you and your students and all that stuff. But if it really is something that's a distraction to the young lady, like her desk, she would talk to him. If it kept going on, she'd go talk to whoever's in authority, the teacher, and the teacher's job is to make sure that thing stops so that she can work and not be distracted and not be nasty and start poking him or kicking him or whatever it is, making fun of him. But those are four minor events. Next thing that's really important for dissension is your kids need to know about gossip, and especially in the upper elementary, junior high, and high school. You should talk to them about what gossip is, how to avoid it, how to deal with it. And because of the time, I'm not going to go into that a lot this morning or this afternoon. Let's go right to dawdling, which is laziness, waste of time, doing nothing. I had one student in particular back in third grade. He was the sweetest kid. But he'd have his pencil out, he'd have his paper in front of him, he'd be poised and ready to go, and we're doing a math assignment or something. I would teach the lesson, say, go get him. And then I'd walk around and help kids and check on how they were doing. 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes later, I'd come by and look at his paper. He'd have nothing written down. And he's just there. And he looked, he's not distracted at all. He's not distracting to anybody around him. And he's not getting anything done. And I can remember circling. You'd give him a little chance, right? Love covers a multitude of sins. Love covers a multitude of sins. He's still not doing anything. And finally, you pull in next to him and say, what are you doing? And he looked up with this big smile on his face. He said, I'm just thinking. And say, well, far be it from me to discourage thinking in a classical Christian school. But the thing that he didn't realize was the value of time, right? The fact that you've got to utilize your time efficiently because you don't have an unlimited amount of it. And so teaching your kids to redeem their time. How do you get right to work? What do you do if you don't know how to solve that problem? And three kids already have their hands up, and you're helping one of the teachers, helping one of them, skip it. Go on to the next one. Use your time wisely. What do you do when you get done? Go on to the next thing. Look at the board. Use your wise time well. And those were lessons that kids really needed to learn in third grade. But if you have someone who's a repeat offender where they're really not using their time wisely and you've taught them and you've trained them, you've talked to them, and you're just not seeing the results that you want, the first thing you need to do is contact their parents. Because what you don't see is all of the work that's coming home, right? When he doesn't utilize his time in class, it expands his workload in the evenings. And what you don't want to do is have the parents not realize how he's not using his time wisely in the classroom, until parent-teacher conference when they come in loaded for bear wanting to know why you've been assigning so much homework. Okay, so you want to work together with the parents and keep them in the loop on these sorts of things. And so we practice. You know, we practice using our time wisely, and that's very important. One last thing, and then I'll let you go. And this is really for the middle of the year. Every year that I've taught, you're ready for the beginning of the school year. You have a number of things in place. You know what you want it to be like. And so you start off really strong on a lot of these fronts. And then you get into the middle of the second quarter or the middle of the third quarter, and it dawns on you one day that things just aren't working as efficiently as they were at the beginning of the year, or you've let some things slip. You know, kids are coming to the classroom and they're talking and they're bringing their conversations into the room and the transitions aren't as tight, and you think, oh, what do I do? It's not like it should be. There are problems here. Well, here's what you do. Here's what I always did. Take a piece of paper and sit down and write all your complaints down. Just list them, right? 7 things or 8 things, problems that you have with your kids or beefs that you have with your class. Write them all down and then look at the list and then take responsibility for the whole thing, right? Because that's your list. You're the one who's responsible for the class. You're the one who sets the tone and allows or doesn't allow certain things to take place. And so own it. Eat the list for yourself. Just say, Lord, this is mine. I'm the one who let it get like this. And then the next thing you should do is take 1 or 2 things from the list, the most important things, what you think is the heart of the problem. Just take 1 or 2 and then leave all the rest behind. Just let them go. Take your 1 or 2 things and go to town on those 1 or 2 things. Talk to the class. Say, here's what I've seen. I've allowed us to do whatever it is. Come in the classroom talking all the time. And I know at the beginning of the year we talked about that and I've let it slip. And I just want you to know it's my fault and I'm sorry for doing it. And I want you to know that from now on, that's not going to take place. And then focus on that 1 or 2 thing, those 1 or 2 things, do a good job on them, and what you'll find almost always is if you go to town on those 2 things and you correct them, those other 5 things on the list are all taken care of. They either weren't that big of a deal in the first place, or they were just downstream fruit of the real heart of the problem. And as soon as that was corrected, everything's back on track. You're good to go. But realize that's part of the ebb and flow of teaching, is it's kind of this repentance process. God shows you something and then thank him and deal with it and realize it's all your responsibility anyway. And so you've got to be the one who eats it. Thank you very much.